Welcome one and all to Talk About It, a podcast by teens for teens, giving teens a platform to discuss the issues that matter to them. Be mental health, music, social issues, sports, anxiety, COVID-19, and so much more. My name is Ameline, the host of this show, and I invite you to settle in to what I think will be a very exciting episode of Talk About It. I can't believe I'm announcing this, but today I am joined by none other than Maria Walsh. Some of you may remember Maria from winning the 2014 Roses Tralee, and others may know her as MEP and member of the Fine Gael Party. I'll be asking Maria about winning the Roses Tralee, her work for the EU, for the LGBTQ plus community, and her work and her coming out experience, and so much more. Hi, Maria. I'm so excited to have you on. How are you keeping?
Hi, how are you? What an introduction. Thanks very much for having me.
You're very welcome.
I think your podcast is absolutely wicked, by the way. I was doing some research prior to this, and your gram, as the cool kids say, is exploding with really great content. Loved it. I learned a lot in your previous episodes.
Wow, thank you so much. That means so much. Thank you so much. I'm really excited. So I better start. We'll start backwards and we'll work our way to now. So you were born in America, but both your parents are from Ireland. If I'm correct in saying that, because I've been doing a bit of research myself.
So I'll get super factual and say you had everything right. My mother was like me. She was born in Boston herself. She's the second youngest of 10 kids, and the younger two, herself and her brother Mike, were born in Boston, but moved back to Ireland when she was 7, and then moved back out to Boston when she was a teenager to live with her older sisters. That was like the thing at the time. But my dad is Irish. She herself would say Irish American. So that's why I say, if she's listening, she's one of my my toughest constituents. So I don't want to be spreading disinformation about her, you know.
No, of course, I completely understand. So, well, that's great that you have both the American and the Irish influence. But I'm going to start by asking you a big question. I hope you don't mind. But what advice would you give your 16-year-old self looking back on your life now?
Oh, my God, this is such a hard question. What advice would I give looking back as my 16-year-old self? You know, there was... I really enjoyed school. I really enjoyed my life. I was very focused on sport. I loved team sportsmanship. I loved, you know, hanging around with the tribe that I had at the time. I also was doing a lot of volunteer projects through like the No Name Club. If anybody doesn't know, it's a youth organization that supports young people from like some do it from second year, junior cert up to leaving cert, and it's around offering a space for younger people to you know, engage and live their lives without the pressures of alcohol and other substances. So, you know, I was a part of that from a very young age because my mother was one of the adults on the committee. And then I also was a pioneer, and there was some peer pressure going on at that age, but not to the extent of what maybe others would experience, because, you know, my friends knew I didn't want to drink or I didn't want to consume alcohol. So for me, it was quite different. But I think in many ways I had such a dedication to figuring out who I wanted to be and what I wanted to do and how best to show up in the world. And I was so values-based, as I am now, but looking back, I don't think I gifted myself the time to actually be a teenager, you know, to have fun. I made a hell of a lot of mistakes, even at that age, but I think my internal demons in terms of my head, you know, my head, my mental health and well-being, why it was perfectly normal and healthy. I just wish I had learned to have fun, learned to like, have the gifts of being present and experiencing what I had at my fingertips versus trying to get to the top of the mountain not knowing where the mountain is, but believing that I had to keep my head down and keep working. Because I had started work in a part-time job when I was 12, and not because we needed it or I needed to do it. It was just more, you know, I love being around people and I love challenging myself. And I was always around a bit of an older crowd. And sometimes I wish, looking back, that, you know, I just given myself the opportunity to not feel like I had to show up in the world as an adult at the age of 16, if that makes sense.
No, it does. It does. And it's interesting that you said that. The becoming a member of that club, becoming a pioneer, did all that influence you in the job that you chose and the career that you wanted to go down?
I mean, in hindsight, in looking back now, you know, I'm like, wow, you know, maybe I was on a path long ago and I didn't realize it. But in many ways, it was just opportunity presented itself. In terms of being a pioneer, you know, my mum's a pioneer, but my siblings drink. They always like me to stress that, you know, we're not a family of pioneers. But I had a role model from the village of Shrule, where I grew up, just on the border between Mayo and Galway, who was a lifelong pioneer and who was very active in the Pioneer Association. And I remember her, Eileen McCarthy was her name, and she'd come in and made this amazing speech. And it was the first time I'd ever experienced a speech that I can still remember how I feel. I can't always remember what she said, but it was that iconic moment where I was like, right, I want to be like her. And I remember, and she looked like she was on a cast of Dallas. She looked American. She had her hair always done. Her makeup was always flawless. She had the shoulder pads. She just looked bloody cool, you know? Yeah. And I remember I want to be like her. And then I guess as soon as that decision was made, for me, you know, and I know we'll get into it around my sexuality, like I made the decision to be a pioneer. I didn't make a decision to of my orientation. That's just who I am. And that's where my process is right now. And that might change and evolve, but I'm pretty sure, you know, for me, the pioneerism was a choice of my own. And that's the type of life I wanted to live and still live. And the orientation was just a part of my DNA. But that experience of becoming a pioneer and being the youth work that you had talked about there, certainly shaped me in feeling a lot more comfortable in my own skin than perhaps my peers did, which allowed me in many ways to get to the point where I'm at now, because I couldn't hide behind anything and I certainly didn't want a crutch. So for me, my stupid mistakes or the possibilities and the learns, you know, I couldn't blame on anything else other than myself. And I guess that made me grow up a hell of a lot faster in some ways.
Yeah. And I was really interested just then when you said you picked being a pioneer, but you didn't pick your sexual orientation, because that's something that a lot of people forget or misjudge, I want to say, because, you know, people say, oh, you know, these people choose to be gay or lesbian or asexual or pansexual, whatever it is. But no,
there's a hell of a lot more pronouns and letters to the rainbow.
Oh my goodness, yes, I could go on and on.
And I was just talking to a colleague of mine who is so pro LGBTQI+, and she was like, if I leave out one letter, I feel like I'm insulting generations. And I'm like, yeah, but there has to be a bit of acceptability to the fact that I often say rainbow individuals or rainbow families or LGBTQI. It depends on what can come out of the mouth, but. I hope in this conversation, anybody listening, if we do miss a letter, it's not out of discrimination. It's just more out of, well, I'm old and might forget a letter.
Well, same here, because I did a episode on the LGBTQ+ community. And then I got a message saying, you forgot these letters. And I was like, yes, no, I didn't, but I can't say them all in one show. You know, and there's so many, and there's always new ones added in. So
yeah. And I mean, much to that point in terms of, you know, and I think I cut you off when you're asking your question around selecting orientation. And some people assume you do, like you wake up in the morning and you're like, right, I'm going to put that rainbow coat on and that's what I'm going to be today. And in some cases, which I love when I talk to schools, because when we're in a small circle and it's really safe and everybody feels accountable to the safety of the conversation, we get great stuff going where, you know, some people might, well, I'm fluid and I'm trying to figure out who I am. And in many ways, some people assume then, well, you're just trying to try on many different coats and you don't know who you are and you're making the choice. When in actual fact, they're just gifting themselves time to figure out who they actually are without the noise and all the BS that society places on us, or the assumptions we place on ourselves and expectations we have on ourselves of upsetting the apple cart around us. Whereas for me, you know, I remember having conversations in my head being like, if that happened to me, I might have seen something on TV or read an article or seen one or two gay people that lived within my community at the time. And it was very seldom. And, you know, I went into first year in the year 2000. So not that long ago, a little bit while ago, but not that long ago. But when you think, you know, gay role models really weren't a thing then, and they certainly weren't in when I was growing up. But I always had this assumption that if I was to be that, I had a very clear understanding for me personally that whatever and whomever I ended up with, be it a male or a female, that it didn't really matter. Like I looked beyond the gender of a person, and I looked at their character and their values versus what, you know, what they came down to earth in whatever type of body. So that for me, now sometimes when I throw that out in groups, they're like, whoa, that's a little bit too flowery. Whereas for me, it's like, well, I mean, ultimately, yeah, that's where equality comes from. You got to stop looking at people for their color, their creed, their orientation, their gender, their mother tongue, whatever it is. We have to stop basically putting people into boxes that feel comfortable for us to put them in, and more about the experience of the person can bring to you and you can bring to that person.
Yeah, I think that's a lovely way to look at it as well. Yeah, I like looking at it that way. But just
how do you convince people to also look at that? I don't have the answer for it quite yet, and I've been running my brain trying to bring that, but in time people hopefully will come to see the value of the person versus all the other labels we attach them.
Yeah, and I think people are starting to look at it a little bit more. I just saw before I went on that Demi Lovato just came out as non-binary. So there are more people coming out and accepting themselves, which I think is so lovely to see. But when you became the Rose Tralee in 2014, my mum asked me this question actually, and I said, oh, I don't know. I saw online that you came out as lesbian publicly 5 days after the Rose of Tralee. And if you want to answer this question, you don't have to, but was that like a purposeful decision? Did you think that would impact the Rose of Tralee, or was it a personal?
Yeah, no, and it's a great question. I'm delighted you asked it. And all's fair in this. If as a 2-year-old politician, I can't talk my way in and way out of one of your difficult conversations, then I'm in real trouble. So don't everything is fair game in this conversation between me and you. No, for me, you know, I'd been gay for a number of years before that. Like I had come out to my family and my close circle of friends, and I was living in the States, and I had been very comfortable in my own skin. I was in a relationship prior to the Rose of Tralee, and it just had ended before I became the Philadelphia Rose of Tralee earlier in the year of 2014. And for me, when the Rose of Tralee happened, because I had quite a, you know, my first girlfriend and I, we broke up, and it was quite traumatic and distressing. And, you know, picture, you know, Dawson's Creek episode breakup here. It was like monumental, and it was my first. So it was like even more scarier. But so for me, you know, come the Rose of Tralee experience, you know, I get very asexual. And for anybody listening going, what does she mean by that? Like I literally, if I'm not in a relationship, I'm working, or I'm volunteering, or I'm following Mayo football, like it's, you know, God's right gift. So yeah. I really don't explore or look at or talk about my orientation. Plus the fact that when people ask me who I am and where I'm coming from, I would always lead at the fact that I'm a pioneer. And really my sexuality is so far removed from my conversation, my focus point, because it is just a part of me. But in all that said, you know, I'm that's not a healthy way to do it either, because I need to be more conscious and probably less ignorant of the fact that, you know, it is new and it is fresh. And by living as I don't like to use the word role model, because I think we all are them, and I think it gets used a little bit too often, but like living as a person very comfortable in my own skin is really important for those around me, and my sexuality is a part of that, being comfortable in my own skin. So to answer your question and not talk around in circles there for you, you know, when I came through the Rose of Tralee experience, like I was with women who were talking about being nurses, teachers, talking about politics. Hillary Clinton at the time was flirting about running in the US. So like, because I was a Philly Rose, but I grew up in Ireland, you know, there was really big interest. We were talking about, I remember getting in really great debate with one of our Roses around art therapy and SNA work. And like, it was so far removed, unless you had a fiance, which one or two of the girls did, or long-term partners, then we talked about them. So for me, my relationship status never came up. And then it was only a day or two after where a journalist had called the Rose of Tralee committee and said, you know, we heard the story, Maria's gay, can we talk about it? And they turned to me and they're like, what? Do you want to make a comment? And I was like, all right, yeah. And like, this is how plain it happened. I was like, oh yeah, no, I am gay. And it was only when I seen, not, and by no means were they discriminated against, were they worried? It was more of, all right, well, then we just need to get into a bit of a protective mode, because some people like to take people's stories and throw them out on a tabloid and not actually cover the whole essence of a person. So when I did the story with the Sun newspaper at the time, you know, a couple of things I had in order to do the story was you had to talk about other things than just me being gay. So like being a volunteer, being a lover of all things work, being a passionate Mayo fan, being all these things, being a pioneer. And then the other thing was, can we just be creative with the headline, not to say like the Rose of Tralee, I'm gay. And one out of one isn't bad. You know, the poor journalist had said I had no authority over the headline. That's their job. So on the Sunday, heading to Crow Park to watch Mayo play Kerry in the first round, I think it was a semi-final, the headlines in the newspaper was Rose of Tralee, I'm gay. And it was really only the next day on the Monday morning when I was watching, I think it was Ireland AM, and they went through the newspapers, that I was like on numerous front covers about my sexuality, and I was the banner ad on the news. And that to me, I was like, oh, obviously this is a big thing here. Yeah. And that's really when it kind of set in, going, wow, my sexuality is going to set this year alight. And I just need to make sure, because I was an older Rose, you know, I was 27, so there was a lot of other international Roses that were quite younger than me, whereas I had lived abroad, I was very comfortable in my own skin. It wasn't like it just happened and I figured out my sexuality within the week of the Rose and then it exploded, you know. So I needed to then kind of step up and make sure I was being as protective of what a gay person could be versus people putting me into boxes to make themselves feel comfortable, you know.
Yeah. That's interesting now, because I didn't know that story. But did you find a big difference between the news in America versus the news in Ireland? Was there a support difference or a story difference?
Yeah, in America it was only within the Irish communities. Okay. There, I remember though, a journalist came over from the United Kingdom to cover the story. And I remember sitting opposite her going, like, why are you here? You know, like, who cares? And she was like, this is a really big story, Marie. And I was like, what time did you get up at to get your flight today? Are you not? And she was like, I just don't think you were. And I always remember this conversation, because I just don't think you realize how big of this moment is. And I was like, mm-hmm. It's not really that big. Like, you know, we drew against Kerry yesterday. That's a big story. And she's like, no, it's not. And it was, and that to me then, and I guess in hindsight, you know, maybe in 5 or 10 years time, when I'm really old and gray and I can look back and say, God, like how the hell did that happen? But I was so fortunate, because I was really, in many ways, the media liked us. And by us, I mean the Rose of Tralee that year. And they were really blown away that, you know, the Rose of Tralee could be gay and have short hair and tattoos and work in fashion and be quite outspoken. But taking away my orientation, you know, there were so many other international Roses that were the exact same. And they just were never gifted. And Roses and escorts, even from my year and years beyond, like they were just never gifted the podium because the media didn't find it topical or sensationalist. So in many ways, we worked the room and the crowd that year to make sure as much as we could get out, we did, because it was really important not only to LGBTQI communities, but modern women, and to the festival as a whole, and the culture that we need to celebrate women regardless of who they are and where they're coming from.
Oh, that, no, definitely. I agree with what you're saying there. And yeah, it is like, it is such a big festival, and for you to be the first lesbian to win it, like, I remember my mum saying it as well, and my grandparents like, oh my god, this is amazing. And you know, it was a big deal. Like, it was, my whole family were just delighted for you. I mean, they're such big fans. Aww. And if I don't say that, they'll all kill me. So so they all say hello, because I'm going to forget otherwise if I don't say it. But no, for them, it was,
they're good people, your family.
Yeah, but they're very proud to be, all my family moved down to Mayo. When my mum moved down to Mayo first, then the rest of my family did. And, you know, we all consider ourselves Mayo people. And, you know, they're very proud to be from Mayo and say, oh yeah, Maria Walsh is from Mayo now. And yeah, it was like a huge sense of pride that, you know, you had done it, and it was such a big story, you know, and we are just.
Yeah, well, and you're so kind to say, you're very so kind to say, but in many ways, I would hope that in all the bigness that the story created, you know, ultimately, if you ask me why I did it and why I was comfortable to put the most personal part of someone's life, their orientation, out there. Yeah. When I think back and I'm like, God, you know, I really went, you know, there was no secrets, and there can't be within that role or within public life in many ways, because the country's too small. And I like to live authentically and transparent as I can, sorry, the word won't come out. But, you know, the aim of the game, I guess, for that whole chapter was that, as uncomfortable it might have been for me to have those conversations, and in many ways it didn't, I was very conscious of my folks though. Like, I decided to put my hand up and get involved in the festival. I didn't imagine I'd be selected, but when I was, you know, I stepped out with a crown and sash and was very public on who I am, whereas my parents weren't. And not that they were any bit, you know, homophobic or uncomfortable about who their kids were, because my younger brother is also gay, so 2 out of 4 in our household. So, but like, to have it splashed and everybody know, is a completely different experience that they didn't sign up for. But in many ways, I guess I took all of that and the potential collateral of that and realized, if you or a friend of yours could have a conversation with their parents about what sexual orientation means and how it is so not about the overall person, then for me it was worth the collateral, or the potential collateral of the fallout that it could have been. I mean, I'm really fortunate it wasn't the case, but you kind of have to outweigh the good than the bad. And for me, it was the benefit was, hopefully one or a few younger people would feel more comfortable to have that conversation, be it as a gay individual or as someone who's just curious about learning and about being a really good ally to the community.
Yeah.
Because both conversations are really important in order to grow an equal society, you know?
Yeah, and I'm delighted you said that, because, you know, that's what the show promotes, just talking about your feelings and talking about what's going on, you know, outside the four walls of your house, and about other people. Like, it is so important. So actually, do you have any advice to a teen or a young adult who might be listening and might be questioning their sexual orientation or their identity?
Yeah, for sure. I think it's so important to first look at how you're talking to yourself internally, because that often determines the tone that you set for the conversations that happen to you externally. And I might be wrong about that, but that's where my gut's going right now in this answer. So I'm going to sit with it. But, you know, I think we put so much pressure on people, young people in particular, to be a version of perfection that isn't in existence. And we put a hell of a lot of pressure on them to know who they are and where they are and what they're going and what they want to do at 15, 16, 17, hell, even younger than that. And I can tell you this, as a 33-year-old who has pivoted more times than I can count in my career and still evolving on a daily basis, if we do not communicate to younger people that education, emotional intelligence, conversations like you and I are having, is a lifelong piece of work that we're constantly going to be doing. And remove the expectations that you have to know all the answers at all times. Like, the pressure any person feels within their mental health and well-being is extraordinary now more than ever. But like, from a younger person where the pressure seems all consuming, be it about their orientation or about a paper not going well or a friendship not developing the way you want it to, or, you know, our home life just not being as supportive as another, then we need to really just, again, I mean, call out to say, I hate to say the line, there's so many resources, but there are a lot of resources out there. And if you know somebody or you are that somebody, then we need to start figuring out ways that you feel comfortable airing and sharing your stories at whatever age. And for me, I hope this conversation and all your conversations offer that comfort, because the more we normalize the fact that we don't all have great days, we have really big struggles. I'm gay and there's points in my life where I'm like, is it easier to be straight than it is to be gay? I don't know. Like, when we start normalizing all the possible questions and dialogues we have in our head, it makes it easier for generations coming behind us. And I think that is probably the advice I would give. And one thing I learned at a mental health talk I was at a couple of years ago was, you know, there's so many great numbers out there and resources at your fingertips. But, you know, the greatest gift you can give yourself and another is whatever number you choose, be it at a house or I'll just take or spun out or belong to either or I know there's a number of numbers. Just call it, go through the process of it. Just say, you know, hi, I'm Maria. I've done it a few times. Hi, I'm Maria. You know, I'm just learning more about mental health and I wanted to practice the number. So if I'm ever in a situation that I need to call or a friend needs me to call on their behalf, I've already took the sting out of the practice, yeah. You know? And that gift you can give yourself of just an experience and taking it the red and green moment that we're going to have where someone is in desperate need of us to make that phone call for them, or we're in that need, then you've already rehearsed it. So it's like muscle memory. And that to me would be the greatest takeaway I would hope people, you know, bring from this, that it's absolutely okay to not know where the feck you're going in life and who you are and how you're showing up. And that's perfectly okay. What's not okay is if you're going to be disrespectful to another person to show up, and you're gonna hurt them physically, emotionally, or mentally. But often those that hurt us are often going through their own mental health struggles. And I think the more we learn about the vocabulary of asking for help and knowing when our own mental health and well-being is off kilter, knowing when our orientation is under pressure, knowing when peer pressure is at a rise, that we're able to step back and look at this is just a chapter within an ongoing lifelong learning chapter, then I think we're in a better space. I'm really sorry. I long-winded that answer. I'm sorry.
No, you didn't. It was a wonderful answer, because I had never thought of it like that, because I know all the numbers. I have, you know, all the numbers saved on my phone because I went to a mental health talk and they said, you know, to always have the numbers saved on your phone. So I have them on my phone. I've never used them and I never thought of using them like that, to have them, you know, to call them and say, you know, my name is Ameline and so and so. But yeah, I never thought of doing that before. And I'm so glad as well you've mentioned the fact that, like, people don't need to know where they're going at this age. I'm very fortunate. I know what I want to do and where I want to go, but I've been talking to so many people because I'm doing my leaving cert next year, and so many people just don't know what to do.
And what's the plans for you? What's your vision?
I'm planning to go to IADT in Dunleerig and do media studies there. So broadcasting and journalism and film and TV and all that kind of stuff.
Good for you.
Yeah, so I'm lucky in that sense that I know, but I know so many other people are struggling just trying to get out of the...
For a real share here, you know, one of the greatest struggles of me getting in even to this career is I was in a relationship a couple of years ago, and my partner worked in media production, and she knew exactly who she was in this world. Like, she knew her hand around the camera was her All-Ireland. You know, it was her moment, and she excelled in it. She was amazing. She was creative at it. She runs a really successful business. She works 7 days a week, 365 days a year as a self-employed female producer, but she's doing it. And one of the big catalysts of our relationship of, and combative pieces is the fact that I didn't know that. I didn't know how I wanted to show up in this world. I knew I had skills, and I knew I had emotional intelligence, and I knew I had a voice because the podium gave me an opportunity of the Rose of Tralee, and I knew the type of person I wanted to be, and because I was that person. But ultimately, I didn't know how to funnel all of those skills that I'd picked up since the age of 12 into a career. And I studied journalism and visual media in college, and I worked in numerous organizations and charities and built that acumen up. But it's so hard to know. And I think we need to really see the value in maybe not knowing and looking at apprenticeships or traineeships or trying different things and pivoting when we need to, in order to protect ourselves. I think in many ways, if you know, and I should make it shorter, my answer shorter than this, but if I knew what I knew now in my previous relationship, I would have shown up a lot more grounded in myself of not knowing in that relationship. And ultimately, I can't say it would have worked out any different. I don't know, but it just would have made me more comfortable in using my own voice and having my own internal confidence of saying I'm figuring it out, versus the expectation on another or a friend or a parent or a teacher to be like, you need to tell me what I wanted to do in this world. And nobody knows that bar yourself. But if you're not gifting yourself the time to figure it out or have the confidence to say, you know what, I'm figuring it out and I don't know, and I'm going to try and we'll see what happens. Win or learn. That's the motto I learned. Win or learn. Never failure. You're only evolving.
Yeah, I love that. I haven't heard that before, and I really like that. But how did you become an MEP then? Because I thought you went straight from the Rose Tralee to.
No. There was a lot of crossroads between. So I won the Rose Tralee in 2014, or I was honored with the title, and then that ended obviously in 2015. I handed over the crown to Alicia Brennan, our Meath Rose. And then I decided to move back to Ireland full-time from Philadelphia. So I kept my full-time job in Philly over my Rose year. So I was doing a lot of 5 days in Philly, weekends in Ireland, or here for a week or there for a week, whatever needed to happen. And I was really fortunate. The fashion company that I worked for at the time was, you know, I don't know, would they ever hire an Irish person under the age of 28 ever again? because they're like, we went through this experience of this Irish girl winning the Rose of Tralee and we haven't seen her in a while. But they allowed me to work remotely and do all my work whenever I needed to be in Ireland or overseas. But anyways, long story short, I decided to move back to Ireland full time and really see if I could generate anything from my Rose Tralee experience. And I always said, I'll give it 1 year. And if I'm not, I'm going back to America with my tail between my legs and try and figure out, go back to Philadelphia and see if I can get back, you know. And I was trying to keep my foot in the door as well in the company I work for, because I loved it. It's just this other thing was really inspiring me and calling me home. So from 2015 then until about 2018, I worked my tail off to try and figure out who I was. So I was working in media. I tried to set up my own production business doing photography, because that's what I would have done in the States, as a producer for it. I worked a little bit with my former partner in TV shows. I would have done some, you know, broadcasting like you're doing now, and bits and pieces, and nothing ever felt right. And then I worked on an event where we honored some of the survivors of the Magdalene Laundries in the summer of 2018. And I would always work on social issues over the course of the few years that I was at home between Rose and where I am now. And it was always, and I went down to the fact where I took out a white sheet of paper when I was so frustrated one day. And I was like, what am I really quick to reply back to? So like, what am I instantly like, an email would come in from a school saying, hey, we'd love to have a chat with you. And I'm like, yes, what day, what works? Another email would come in around like something else within the media realm, and I would leave it a day or two and then go back. So like, that's a clear indication that, you know, there's some energy there and there's some not energy. So I worked on this event, and I decided post that to gift myself, it was my birthday gift, a 1-day seminar with Women for Election. And it was held in Dublin, and an amazing organization. There's some others there too, like Northwest 50-50. There's another great group in Longford, but Women for Election are certainly the leaders in trying to bring diversity into our political spectrum. And there I went in, and I loved it because I wasn't the Rosa Tralee, or I wasn't a potential candidate, or I wasn't anybody other than a female who was trying to figure out if she could show up in this world and do any good. And it was a packed house, and I learned about quotas and constituencies and different parties and their values. And long story short, from that summer until the end of 2018, I was trying to figure out if I was to run where I would run. And I met with Fine Gael General Secretary at the time, Tom Curran, and I wanted to go in and ask about local elections. That was where I wanted to see, because I'm built in community activism. That's the household I grew up in. That's my DNA. And he had flowed the idea around European elections. And I remember that 5-minute conversation with him. I stepped out aside of Fine Gael headquarters, and I text 10 of my friends across various networks. So like some with the Rose, some with, community projects, wherever. And I asked, like, what does an MEP do, and who's your local MEP? And 9 of them came back saying, I don't know.
Oh, wow.
So for me, it became me not running. It became a movement. And I sat more comfortably in the movement of running then, because like the Rosa Tralee, you know, I love to challenge expectations and lift a few brows and really push beyond the unconscious biases of some. So that to me then became the campaign, and not seeing my face on a poster. It's like, I have to go through my face on a poster in order to make sure that younger people see themselves in politics, and we can get more women, and we can get more gay, rural female politicians that live in the middle of nowhere in the European Parliament talking about gay women living in rural Ireland who need to get involved in politics, you know? So for me, it became a sustainable cycle then of a conversation. So yeah, and then I put my shoulders to the wheel and try to convince a lot of people in Fine Gael and then outside people to say, take a chance on me. And I was really fortunate that they did. And now I'm delighted to say those living across Midlands, Northwest, the 13 counties, Galway, Donegal, Mayo, across the Louth, are stuck with me until 2024.
Well, that's super. I'm delighted we're stuck with you. Can I ask you a bit of a, I don't want to say a political question, but a political question. So I learned the other day, and this really shocked me, that conversion therapy is actually still legal in Ireland. I didn't know this. I learned this on my TikTok page. Would you imagine? This is one thing that I learned. So what's your, I don't want to say your stance on it, but what's your,
what's your take on it? For sure. Yeah. You know, right now, only Germany, across the EU, only Germany and Malta have banned it for minors. So it's still legal for adults. I think it's disgusting. I think in 2021, I don't understand how we got to this point and we're sitting comfortably with it. In many ways, I don't know if it was an oversight in some countries like our own. I'm kind of hoping it was, but I don't think it was. I think it was a case of marriage equality came and everything else would kind of fall away, because we would set the standard that we are welcoming of all individuals and their partners. But in actual fact, beyond that, we don't have equality in for our trans community. We still don't have equality around rainbow families or we still have conversion therapy not banned. So in the parliament, we're creating, I sit in an LGBTQI intergroup, and it's political wide. So by that, I mean all bar the far right is involved in the intergroup. And we're really trying to work with the commissioner, Helena Daly, our commissioner for equality, and our president commissioner, Savannah Deline, to make and put pressure on communities and member states like Ireland to ban it. There's some in east of the union that don't want to ban it and don't want to ban it outright and have said it. In Ireland, I'm very hopeful that we'll see it banned in a very short period of time, but yeah, it's disappointing that regardless in Ireland, whether you sit left or right or center, wherever your political acumen is, it doesn't really matter. I mean, I thought I was really surprised too. And I learned it here in the Parliament. It didn't even come across my radar that conversion therapy would even be a thing in 2021 or 2021, you know, in Ireland. Like it's nuts. But there's no full stop on this end of the sentence. It's one of the things my team and I will see banned. We're aiming for by the end of this mandate.
Yeah, well, that's fantastic to hear, and it's reassuring to hear as well, because I was watching Reeling really, in the Ears with my family. Yeah, it is. And I said it to one of my friends and she didn't even know what it was. So after explaining it to her, she was like, oh my God. I was like, yeah, I know. But we were watching Reeling in the Ears, me and my family. Was it last Sunday night? And the 2015 Reeling in the Ears came on, and it was the year that gay marriage was legalized in Ireland. And I still remember to this day watching it in my sitting room. But it was, you know, seeing it on TV, I just kind of thought, you know, we are the first country in the world to legalize it by popular demand. So by like popular vote, even. So, you know, why wasn't conversion therapy part of that? Yeah. But no, I'm delighted to hear you say that.
But in those cases, and I don't have a clear answer for you, other than the fact that in those cases, that's where the black and white of what politics means is very different. Mm-hmm. You know, for me and you, it's quite rational to say, but marriage equality came in, so therefore everything should fall into line, because people and popular demanded that we have marriage equality. So therefore you would imagine in whatever year, in whatever society, that everything falls into place, that equality actually means equality, wherein an actual between legislation, policy, and the other mindset, it's not like that. There's a lot of loopholes. There's a lot of gray area. There's a lot of slowness to the fact that society moves a hell of a lot faster than the political spectrum. And ultimately, I'm not trying to wash away the fact that I'm a part of a party in government that haven't had that banned yet. I'm very aware of that. And in many ways, I'm embarrassed that we even have to have this conversation. But in other ways, then I'm really glad me and you are having this conversation, and I'm really glad I'm in politics, and I'm hoping you and anybody listening would think about getting involved in politics, be it as a candidate or behind the scenes or a journalist that covers the political landscape, because if we don't ask those questions for generations to come, then the black and white becomes really colorful and not in our favor.
Yeah.
If that makes sense, you know.
No, it does. Yeah. But no, I was one of the top 25 public speakers in Connacht in 2018. Woo, woo, woo. And I went to the All-Ireland debating finals. Was it 2 years ago now? So yeah, it's always a route that I like to say that I've gone down, and I'm not, like you said, foot in the door. Like I met Maria, not Maria, Mairead McGuinness. I met Mairead McGuinness at the finals, and she gave an amazing speech. I just, yeah, like you said earlier, it's one of those speeches that stay with you, and yeah. Such a wonderful person.
We need role models like that, you know, yeah. And not just the Mairead's or myself. We need like folks like you that are willing to put your hand up and get involved in those extracurricular activities that are only going to encourage you and put you in spaces that you hear from speeches like from our commissioner now, Mairead McGuinness,
yeah.
In order to spark more seeds and for you to get into some sort of public life, be it through, you know, what you're doing now to putting your hand up and running for president or Taoiseach or whatever.
Yeah. So I hate to say it, but I better ask you the final two questions, because unfortunately we're running out of time. But can you tell me, I always ask the same two questions to every person I interview, so could you tell me a quote that you live by, if there is one?
Ooh, I mean, the quote I said earlier there about win or learn, and that only recently came into my life. Because I'm not traveling as much with COVID restrictions, I try to, I'm a great woman for not wanting to sit still, which is a whole other podcast in itself. But I did a coaching course with the Irish Life Coaching Institute. So come this weekend, I'm officially a life coach and development coach, which is really cool. But one of the things we learned early on in that session was win or learn, and our mentality around not looking at failures or defeats. It's actually a learning opportunity to bridge the next one. I'm going to be super cheeky and slide in a second one because I have a tattooed on my arm. I did, as I was explaining, the Magdalene Laundries event, the survivors. And right after that one, I got a quote on my arm to say, "Here's to those who inspire us and don't even know it." And I think that's really apt, where you just don't know the conversations or the seeds that are being planted, and you don't have to have a title or a really kick-ass mic or sit in a fancy office to inspire somebody. And the more we take that stigma or that taboo away, that you need to be at the top of the mountain in order to inspire or create inspiration, the more and more we have people feeling polarized that they can't be what they see. And ultimately that's the two I live by.
I love the last one. That was a good one as well. Because, you know, there's so many people in my everyday life personally as well that inspire me and who have, you know, impacted me in doing this show. And they know who they are. So thank you to them. I'm going to say thank you now.
Kudos to your entourage. Kudos to your entourage.
Can I ask you a bit about the life coach, actually, and yeah, what you did with that?
Yeah, so for me, you know, I work and I try and work in the mental health and well-being space. And I don't know, was it society who taught me that if you don't have a qualification that you can't really add your voice or your value? And in order to take away the confidence piece that I had about that, I decided to do a life coaching course with the Irish Life Coaching Institute. And it was over, I started last October, I finished this weekend coming in at the end of May. And it really was a great challenge of introspective work. So like, what are my own biases? How do I talk or think about myself? How am I showing up? And really it was, what I say about talking about mental health to younger people in particular, but I manage a team of four women. And how we talk to each other is really important, because that will ultimately determine what they do next and what I do next. And if we have a really great, honest, vulnerable culture that works really hard, but can lean on each other when we need to, that's a phenomenal legacy piece to leave if 2024 doesn't work out and I don't decide to rerun or whatever the future will hold. But for me, it was around showing up for them better, showing up for my constituents better. And you know, like you would know, I mean, you get stopped quite a bit out and about, regardless of who you are. And you know, we walk past people all the time. We say, "Hiya, how are you getting on?" And we keep moving. Whereas this course really taught me that, sure, I'm a qualified coach. I can do one-on-one hours and I can build a business if I want. But for me, it was more, you know, being able to see signs of someone just needing to have a conversation and showing up authentically. And actually listening versus what I did here now and completely over talk. So I'm sorry about that. But you know, being having those that tool belt of resources to know that I have been through the coaching course, I've done a number of pro bono hours, I've been challenged, I've been assessed, I did all my qualifications, and now I feel confident in being able to show up to someone if they're in distress or they just need to offload, or they need a safe space to talk about something, that I'm as skilled as I can be to support that person. So that's one course, and then I'm also doing my farming course. I'm doing a Green Cert course with Chagas, because I love farming. That's my hobby. That's my mental health space. So by this weekend though, I'm back to weekends and back to a little bit more constituency work now that the face-to-face stuff, now that the country is opening up, which is exciting.
I know, it's great, and that the country's opening up. And I know I said final two questions, but I have to ask about, you mentioned there about mental health, and was that something over lockdown that you, you know, took care of and you saw the impact of?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, at the start of it, I probably didn't take care of my own mental health enough. I was really quite conscious of my team and you know, it's really difficult. Listen, a lot more people went through a lot more harder stuff than I did. I'm really fortunate that I came out unscathed, in the sense of no, I had no direct member of my family or immediate family get lost to COVID, like many did. But I did, I lived through the energies of other people. So being around, gathering and meeting people, you know, being out and about, working with my team, when you take that all away, like many, I struggled to find my equilibrium of it all. I was like, whoa, you know, if I'm not out there, you know, doing something, then how do the people know that I'm working? Where in actual fact, I actually work every day and I work really hard. And who am I trying to prove other than the fact that I'm really trying to do my best? And do they do people physically need to see me in order to know that I'm doing the best for them? No, but I need to find other avenues in order to communicate to them so that they know that I'm here if they need it to be. So I really had to pivot and challenge my own mental health. There's points where I certainly struggled. I got COVID at the end of October, and coming out of it, I picked up long COVID, and there was days where, and still experience fatigue, brain fog, muscle fatigue. And I'm kind of kicking myself going, like, move, like, you're 33 years of age. Like, you used to be able to walk up the stairs. What are you doing? When in actual fact, you know, I really had to sit in my mental health and well-being and say, like, you know, self-care is so important. Burning the candle at both ends is not sustainable. And ultimately, if I don't feed myself well, if I don't sleep enough, if I don't exercise enough, then, well, no conversation is going to be fruitful. And I won't be able to, I won't even be able to get to the end of 2024, never mind try and put my hand up again to run. And, yeah, and that's not sustainable. So I really struggled at points. I'm really fortunate I had rural Ireland though on my doorstep, so I was able to farm and do all those good things that go beyond, you know, your immediate perspective. When things weren't going right, I went out to the farm and I talked to my four-legged animals, and they looked at me as if, you know, get away, I have my own things to be doing. But and then me and my team were really honest about how we felt we were showing up for each other. And there was days where, you know, I had a team member call me saying, I need a mental health day today, and absolutely take it. Another team member, there's times where I dropped in a message to say, you know what, if you don't need me, there's not a lot going on in the diary. I'm going to try and pick up on calls to feed myself with people that I know would give me energy in order for me to show up better for you later on today. So I think that's for us how we survived COVID.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think everyone's kind of realized now that, you know, mental health was such a big thing and it impacted everybody at one stage or another, be it lockdown 1, 2 or 3. Look after yourself.
And even what your podcast is gifting people is the fact that each and every one of us have mental health and well-being. Like, we all have it.
Yeah.
Some of us have a mental health illness, and that's a really difficult thing to work through. But not everybody has mental health illness, but we all have mental health. And even the language and talking about it and understanding that none of us are getting out of here without experiencing at least a few blue days, and we need the support systems around to help us through that, then I would hope that is probably one of the biggest benefits of having COVID, where Mother Earth said, I'm going to stop you all, and you need to look at yourself, figure out what kind of humans you want to be, and how we support each other in a community.
Yeah, no, definitely, definitely. And it's gifted all of us in one way or another. But okay, last question for real now. what's one thing you would like everybody to take away from our conversation here today?
Oh, this is the hardest question. I'll just go with what's in my brain and what my gut is pushing. For me, one of the biggest takeaways I hope people come away with listening to our hopefully enriching conversation, people believe, is the fact that just because you feel you have equality, or we think we got equality, particularly in the gay community in 2015, doesn't mean equality is done.
Yeah.
And I think the more inequality around our mental health resources, equality around better work-life balance, equality around what type of communities we want to live in, the equality around women being paid adequately, the equality around our trans communities, conversion therapy, you know, equality can disintegrate us as quickly as a blink of an eye. And it's not something that you just get a rubber stamp on your passport and says, you know, I vote in, we have equality, and it's done. It has to be hard fought again and again and again. And that's probably one of the biggest takeaways. And that I hope for everybody's mental health and well-being that Mayo win the All-Ireland soon.
Oh, fingers crossed. That would be amazing. That would fix everybody's mental health in the West, I think. Yeah. Listen, Maria, it was absolutely wonderful to talk to you. Thank you so much for coming on. And I really, really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for asking me. I'm so grateful, and love to all the family and friends. And thank you very much for giving me a piece of your podium to talk and share. And I'm really grateful for the opportunity and to be challenged by your questions. And I learned a hell of a lot. And I think when you have two people sharing, communicating and conversing, then we're in a lot better world, aren't we?
We are indeed. We are indeed. Thank you so much, Freya.
Mind yourself.
And before we finish this episode, I'm delighted to announce that this week's young musician is Emmeline Gracie with her original song A Million Times. And can I just say how beautiful the song is? I absolutely love it. It's now reached over 5,000 streams and it's just amazing. And I really, really hope you enjoy it. I hope you enjoyed this episode entirely. If you did, I would really appreciate it if you left a review. Comment, let me know what you think of it. I always love hearing back from people. So yes, I hope you enjoy this song and I hope you have a wonderful week.
Just a single drop and I'm giving in. I let you hold me again. Nothing much has changed, but I'm not the same. And it kills to think about you. There's something delicate, something haunting about our pain, and I'm hiding in my cave, growing lonely by the minute. I think it looks like rain, so I stay in. I stay awake, cause I know about what you would never say. I know about her, and I know she stays. So if you fall in love for a million times and a million more, would you know me if you waded through the tides of a million shores, a million miles to go? Let me unravel in the open, in the pool of your water till I catch my breath. I just need to know if you can find me in the chaos of it all. So if you fall in love for a million times and a million more, would you know me if you waded through the tides of a million shores, a million miles to go? Takes me to the place where I see you playing like a tape recorder. We walk between the lines, the matching and still open. So if you fall in love for a million times and a million more, would you know me if you waded through the tides of a million shores, a million